It's an election year in the United States, which always makes for interesting debate and widespread media coverage. But in the context of coronavirus, Black Lives Matter, Donald Trump, and American economy in freefall, this year's race has taken on a particular importance. Will we see the downfall of the Donald? And what might President Joe Biden do differently? With me to discuss that and much more is the one and only Anna Kasparian, host and executive producer at The Young Turks. Anna, thank you for finding the time to come on Navarra Media. We are supremely grateful for it. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, Aaron. Thank you so much for having me.
We have a lot of stories to get through tonight. Unsurprisingly, I'm sure many of our viewers are familiar with a few of them. Let's start with the first one. This is probably one that our British audience hasn't seen, isn't familiar with. You were tweeting about it earlier on today, Anna. This is about America's eviction crisis. Let's get this up from CNBC, Gary. Really, really remarkable story. Here's a quote. On Friday, the federal moratorium on evictions and properties with federally backed mortgages and for tenants who receive government-assisted housing expired. The Urban Institute estimated that provision covered nearly 30% of the country's rental units. White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow said on Sunday that he would extend that moratorium, but these tenants are now unprotected from eviction. At the same time, some 25 million Americans will stop receiving the $600 weekly federal unemployment checks by July 31st. Now, this is where it gets frightening. By one estimate, some 40 million Americans could be evicted during the public health crisis. Quote, it's like nothing we've ever seen, said John Pollock, coordinator of the National Coalition for Civil Rights Council. In 2016, there were 2.3 million evictions, Pollock said. There could be that many evictions in August. Anna, is this one of those stories that just comes from nowhere and it's kind of, you know, unnecessarily provocative, or is there some real meat here? Could we see tens of millions of Americans really struggling to make ends meet when it comes to rental arrears?
Well, there's certainly raw meat there. And this is an ongoing problem in the United States. We had a real issue with affordable housing in the US even prior to the pandemic. And in Los Angeles, where I live, for instance, prior to the pandemic, we had 60,000 homeless individuals. These are people living out on the streets. They're children in some cases. There isn't a single freeway bridge where you won't see tents and unhoused people living in complete and utter squalor. And Los Angeles is dominated and controlled by Democrats. And when Republicans are critical of Democrat-run cities, they actually do have a point. Because what we're seeing right now is, on one hand, you have Republicans who want to solve the problem in the cruelest way possible, criminalize individuals who are living out on the streets, force them into institutions. Whereas the mainstream Democratic Party in America thinks that the right thing to do, the so-called humane thing to do, is avoid saying anything negative about homelessness, don't judge the homeless, but also simultaneously ignore the problem and pretend as though it does not exist. And so it's become, you know, a humanitarian issue. It's become a public health crisis, especially in the middle of this pandemic. And considering the inaction by Congress in response to what's likely to happen with evictions, the problem is only going to get worse. And so we have seen an increase in violence. While Republicans might argue incorrectly that that violence has stemmed from Black Lives Matter protests, in reality, a lot of this violence is carried out through acts of desperation. People who need to put food on the table for themselves or their children, people who are desperate and will do anything and everything in order to survive. And so really, we have a broken system in this country with two parties that are just not adequate enough to address this very serious problem.
Has the homelessness issue become more visible over the last several months? Obviously, it's been an increasingly conspicuous problem in America since 2008, but is there a noticeable kind of shift upwards since early March?
Absolutely. It's very visible. It's a very big problem. So for me, first and foremost, housing is a human right. Healthcare is a human right. We live in one of the wealthiest countries in the world. We have hundreds of billionaires living in the United States. And at the same time, to see my fellow Americans out there living this type of life of desperation, of poverty, living in squalor, not knowing whether they're going to survive to the next day. It's beyond shameful. I mean, we have a lack of leadership in this country. And I know that most of the focus, for I think justified reasons, has been on Donald Trump because of his incompetence, his cruelty. But at the same time, unfortunately, we do not have a powerful enough opposition that's willing to do what is right to protect Americans, not only when it comes to their basic needs, but even at this point, when it comes to their constitutionally protected rights. That is what we're experiencing right now out on the streets when it comes to peaceful protesters who are met with violence at the hands of federal agents. And what are Democrats doing? I mean, local politicians are saying that they want these federal agents out, but that's not good enough. I mean, Republicans, to their credit, are incredibly aggressive. When they set their sights on something, they get it done. And unfortunately, they set their sights on all the wrong things. Whereas Democrats play these ridiculous games. They love the political theater. They love the optics of resistance. But when push comes to shove, if you look at the way they craft legislation, it is abundantly clear that they have only assisted Donald Trump. They have assisted the Department of Homeland Security when it comes to cracking skulls out on the streets in America right now. Nancy Pelosi and Democratic leadership are fighting tooth and nail to ensure that the surveillance capabilities of the Department of Homeland Security get expanded. And that is a real problem when you see this very government agency doing what it's doing right now on the streets in response to these protests.
So you think it's fair to say that amongst the Democratic establishment, there's a greater emphasis still on funding, wars abroad, CIA, NSA, domestic policing. That's still the priority when it comes to federal tax dollars rather than eliminating homelessness. Is there at least the attempt at sort of moralizing rhetoric from Democratic politicians saying we should be doing better than this? A kind of JFK or Joseph Kennedy. It might be vacuous, it might be meaningless, it might not be backed up with any sort of specific concrete policy. But is there at least a leaning into that moralizing language, or are they not even trying that?
The moralizing language is there. I think most people, voters and people on the left who are paying attention, know that it's just empty words at this point. It's just rhetoric. I mean, I can't help but think of Nancy Pelosi doing her sarcastic clap during Trump's State of the Union address. And the reason why I bring it up is because that moment really does epitomize what the so-called resistance movement is among establishment Democrats in the United States. When you have the Jerry Nadlers and the Nancy Pelosi's in Congress arguing for expanded surveillance for the Department of Homeland Security, how can you argue that there's any substantive difference legislatively between Democrats and Republicans? Now, what Democrats have been doing in this country for a few decades now is they have leaned in to weaponizing identity, really, identity politics. We absolutely do have a problem with racism and inequality in this country, but they are unwilling to do what it takes legislatively to address it. Instead, they have used the topic of racism or sexism, homophobia, whichever issue you want to talk about, as a way to destroy their political enemies, as a way to destroy the potential of a progressive candidate who might want to primary an establishment Democrat. And I wish that more voters were privy to it, because what we're seeing is a complete act of negligence by Congress, by Democrats, when it comes to just the basic human needs of America today, of Americans today.
It's not something I put in the script, but we talked about it briefly before coming on air. There was that story a couple of weeks ago that came out about the Russians paying the Taliban to shoot at NATO troops, you know, US individuals around, because it's not necessarily just US soldiers. It could be defense contractors. It could be, you know, advisors, etc. First of all, nobody needs to pay Afghans to shoot at these people. They've been doing it voluntarily for the best part of 15, 16 years. I had heard an interesting hypothesis from some places, which is, look, Trump is actually quite serious about getting out of Afghanistan. He would actually like to do that. The Democratic establishment very much keen on, you know, perpetuating the war on terror, are very keen on ensuring that the budget serve, the Pentagon, the NSA, the Department for Defense will stay, you know, incredibly bloated. Do you sort of, do you think there's something in that? Because it seems interesting to me, again, it's from an outsider's perspective, and it's why I don't really think the resistance argument really carries any weight. I'm saying resistance, resist, resist. And the second it comes to budgets for militarized policing domestically or wars abroad, Democrats like Nancy Pelosi going, how much do you want? You know, where do I sign? Is that a fair assessment, or am I being a bit ridiculous in saying that perhaps there are parts of the Democratic establishment that want U.S. soldiers, U.S. forces to stay in Afghanistan, arguably longer even than perhaps Donald Trump?
Well, I don't think you're crazy. I think that that's actually a pretty sound argument if you look at the facts and you take the mainstream media reporting and really analyze it with a more skeptical lens. So I'll tell you why I believe in what you're saying. And I also shared this very same assessment on our show, The Young Turks. So you're absolutely right. The Taliban sees the United States as an occupying force. They want the United States out. Donald Trump was about to announce the withdrawal of thousands of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. And right before that was going to happen, the New York Times essentially served as a stenographer for whoever they spoke to, of course, a bunch of anonymous sources. And these anonymous sources argue that, oh, no, well, look at Russia is paying the Taliban. They're arming the Taliban. And we got to remain in Afghanistan, which the problem is the Democratic Party is funded by the exact same special interests that the Republican Party is funded by. That is precisely the reason why you see such similarities when it comes to their actions legislatively, when it comes to the narratives that you hear regarding war and who supposedly serves as a national security risk to the United States. Now, in 2017, there was a hearing where Jim Mattis, who is a giant war hawk, testified and responded to allegations that Russia had been supplying the Taliban with weapons. Jim Mad Dog Mattis said on the record during his testimony that he had not seen any evidence indicating that Russia had funded or in any way supplied weapons to the Taliban. And he wasn't the only one. There were other officials there who testified. They said the same thing. So this narrative had already started years ago. And then all of a sudden, you know, the New York Times just a few weeks ago drops this story with absolutely no evidence. And we remain in Afghanistan. The private contractors who want to see an increase in military funding, who want to see the Pentagon get the taxpayer dollars that they've been getting and more, got what they wanted. And just recently, I mean, this really does help summarize what the Democratic Party is really about. I read a tweet about how Congress has agreed that they will rename military bases, military bases that had been named after Confederate soldiers. In that same tweet, it was also announced that they have approved more than $700 billion in funding for the Pentagon. So it goes back to what I was saying earlier about the optics of change, the optics of resistance. Now, do I agree with changing the military base names? Of course, that's great. But does that fundamentally improve the lives of Americans? Does that fundamentally change our foreign policy? Of course it doesn't. It doesn't. And so when it comes to like the important funding, legislation, I really do feel that in many cases, Democrats and Republicans are on the same side because they're funded by the same special interests.
Now, tell me if I'm going a bit too sort of below the belt here, but with Nancy Pelosi, you know, she's worth almost $100 million. It's alleged that she's worth as much as $100 million, her and her husband. She's 80 years old. I mean, to me, it just seems, because again, I'll be honest, in British politics, you know, we have some people who come from incredibly old, you know, families and so on. But the plutocratic element, the sort of Michael Bloomberg's, the Nancy Pelosi's, there's a few of those individuals. One is Zach Goldsmith, worth as much as £300 million. Fortunately, he's terrible at politics. But I find it hard to believe that Nancy Pelosi has any credibility with anyone when she's an 80-year-old worth that much money. And yet she's meant to be kind of one of the lead voices in the sort of national conversation when it comes to progressive causes. Where does her legitimacy come from? Is it entirely from the donor base, or are we from the left sort of overcooking it a bit? Is there actually a social constituency of support for Nancy Pelosi that we just don't necessarily appreciate as perhaps younger millennial socialists?
Well, I really do believe that one of the biggest problems is the media. And so luckily, independent journalism is growing in the United States, and young people certainly do consume their news that way, fortunately. But if you watch mainstream media, network news, cable news, what have you, or if you rely on the stenographers over at the New York Times or the Washington Post, you know nothing. You really know nothing. And the amount of articles that were published about Nancy Pelosi's so-called resistance blows my mind. Because again, it's all about the optics. It's all about ripping up a stupid speech. What does that do to improve anyone's life? Nothing. It's all about, oh, did you see that sarcastic clap? It means nothing. And one thing that I also want to note is that Nancy Pelosi and Democratic leadership has quite a bit of power. And with that power, they are able to destroy reputations of individuals who speak out against them. I mean, I've seen this happen over and over again when it comes to progressive candidates who choose to challenge, these establishment Democrats in these congressional seats. I've seen it happen. I've seen the smears. I've seen the types of disinformation campaigns that come out of nowhere. And the most frustrating thing about it is that the American left, I'm keeping it real, falls for it over and over again. The smear campaign comes out and so-called leftists in America want to be the good guys. They don't want to get criticized. And rather than investigating that story, rather than looking into it and being skeptical, considering where the story is coming from, they do the virtue signaling online. I see it every day and it's shameful. Okay. Yeah. We're not going to get anything done unless the American left wake up and realize that the sources that they're relying on, the smear campaigns that they're trusting in, are only further dividing us on the left. And as a result, we have no power. We really have no power. That's the reason why the DNC platform has not only rejected Medicare for All, they rejected something as simple as legalizing marijuana. And so the DNC not only wants to show us that they oppose us, they want to embarrass us because they can.
You know, for a British audience, I think that's just so, everything you've just said is so familiar. So on the one hand, there's the virtue signaling element. I don't like to use that word, but I think there's not really a better term for it, quite frankly, which is, look, we're on the left. We want, you know, there's a lot of people who sort of, especially progressives, who base their politics on, I'm a nice person. And sometimes you have to actually say something which might be quite unpopular. So when Evo Morales was being removed in an undemocratic coup last year, and everybody's saying, well, you know, he was going for a fourth term. That was a little bit controversial. This is probably good. After all, he's an indigenous leader. He wanted, you know, an element of public ownership, not that much public ownership, by the way. It's probably the right thing that he goes. And the left doesn't kick up that much of a fuss in this country. You see it, you know, time and time again. Do you think that now that Sanders is gone, he's obviously still in frontline politics, but his hopes of being a presidential candidate, I think, are gone for good. Now that Sanders is gone, now that Corbyn is gone, do you think there's an element of people on the sort of on the left, but who still participate in broad left politics, who have some engagement with the Democratic Party or the Labour Party? Do you think people like you and myself and many of our viewers can be a bit more, not belligerent, but assertive in their politics with establishment media, establishment politicians, in a way that simply wasn't possible over the last several years, because fundamentally we needed them. We needed to build coalitions with them. That's not true to the same extent, at least at the moment. So do you think that that kind of perspective could change a little?
I certainly do think that. But I don't know if this problem is unique to the United States. The real, you know, obstacle I see in our way is the inability of the left to really unite and to deal with its issues or disagreements internally, rather than giving into the social media incentives of fighting publicly. because that division is exactly what the elite class wants. They want us to focus inward and attack one another, create factions within the left. Because if there are factions, then we're powerless. And so I really do see that as the top obstacle at the moment. And the thing is, when you know that your fellow leftists have your back, then you feel empowered to speak the truth. You speak the truth with no fear because you know that you are part of a group of people who understand you, who have your back, and will not give into the smear campaigns that might likely arise from you talking about a class, because that's really at the root of many issues in this country and around the world. I mean, we just constantly get distracted by narratives coming from the elite class. And I don't know how to combat that, because I think people within the left are good. I think they are. I think they want to do the right thing. And just because they might have the right political policies in mind doesn't mean that they're not susceptible to falling for narratives coming from individuals who want to divide us. And so I don't know what the answer is. You know, Michael Brooks, who unfortunately passed away, I think was so incredibly important, not only because he informed Americans on foreign policy and things that were happening around the world, but because he was able to communicate what I just talked about in such a clear and concise way. And also in an entertaining way that really did draw in an audience.
Yeah, we'll be talking about Michael towards the end of the show. Obviously, for any of our audience who are unfamiliar with Michael Brooks's work, he'd been on Navarra previously, passed away last Monday, I believe. He was 36, 37. You worked together on a show. It was with Jacobin. You're obviously at TYT. You're also on Twitter. Again, this isn't really a question I scripted, but given what you've said, and I think it has particular pertinence, you know, with the passing of Michael. And his work and his thinking on this, he'd written a book about, you know, the relationship of digital culture and progressive politics and so on. You're on Twitter. You're also a left media personality. I hope you don't mind me using that term. I mean, I'd apply it to my colleagues as well. Do you think that the left should get off Twitter? Do you think it does feel like it's something of a drain in terms of attention, resources, time? And it feels like if all that was just directed into local media projects, national media projects, starting new things, you know, empowering, you know, existing and preceding sort of efforts, perhaps that would be a better use of time. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
I would love if there were actually a movement to do just that. I used to think that Twitter was necessary in order to remain relevant in media, to promote your work. And I think if you're disciplined enough to avoid your mentions and disciplined enough to avoid, some of the mob culture that takes place on social media platforms like Twitter, it can be useful. But the problem is it's incredibly difficult to not be influenced by certain things that go on Twitter. And, you know, I just see many insincere interactions happening, a lot of bad faith arguments. And I bring that up because those arguments aren't about working out differences or having a conversation to find some common ground. You know, capitalism has a huge negative impact on media and on media personalities because everyone's fighting one another to be the most unique, to be the most interesting, to be the most entertaining, because that's what you need to do in order to earn enough money to survive, especially if you're in independent media. So when I talk about the incentive structure to essentially be a terrible person on social media, that's what I'm talking about. You know, whether they know it or not, whether it's totally conscious or subconscious, people definitely engage in all sorts of disingenuous nonsense, hoping that someone will write about it, it'll get a little bit of attention, and that nonsense catfight will give them some legitimacy and improve their numbers. That's what happens on Twitter, yeah, literally on a daily basis.
Yeah, though you can see the sort of logic. They'll get something, will get 1,000 retweets, they'll get a couple of dozen new followers, and like you say, they just repeat the behavior. And I can't help but think of the kind of post-war move you get in the United States and also here in the UK towards sort of new right, And it basically starts in 1945. You get, you know, The Road to Serfdom written by F.A. Hayek. But by the 50s, the 60s, these guys are building their think tanks. They're getting their politicians. They're beginning to sort of create the foundation for what became sort of neoliberal hegemony with Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. But that was a long movement of, you know, for instance, in this country, the Institute for Economic Affairs was started by Anthony Johnson, I believe. He was a chicken farmer. He wanted to make all of, he met Hayek in the late 40s. He wanted to make all of this money so that he could start, you know, these right-wing think tanks. He started, I believe, something called the Atlas Foundation. It sponsors right-wing think tanks around the world. And I think, God, what if this guy, rather than do all that, had just tweeted, you know? And it's quite a worrying thought. You know, you had these kind of really high-energy, devoted people coming from the right, building ideas, building organizations, building candidates, building a whole different politics, waiting for, you know, that great quote that comes from Milton Friedman about, you know, we're about passing on the tools to the next generation of people so they have them to hand when the crisis hits. And I think, God, they did that for 40, 50 years. Had there been Twitter, maybe they wouldn't. Is that the mistake that we're making?
Possibly, but I also try to remind myself that even though it feels like Twitter is real life, Twitter is not real life. There are plenty of people out there who don't use Twitter. They don't really understand what the use of Twitter is. And, you know, I think what we do need to focus on is finding ways to connect with workers. Because if we can organize workers, if we can find a way to focus on the one mission or the one common, like the common ground that we share, I think that we can do incredible things. I mean, when you really think about it, put all of all the differences aside, culture stuff, put all the culture stuff aside and focus solely on what I think the vast majority of people agree should be considered and are human rights, healthcare, housing, you know, just food, clothing, the basics to have a life of dignity, right? If we can focus on that, laser focus, and not get distracted by the culture wars that the elite class wants us to get involved in, then I think we can accomplish great things, even with the obstacles of Twitter and social media and all the noise that we're seeing. But it's hard. It's hard to do that. I think one of the most difficult things to do is create a culture on the left that's welcoming and forgiving, right? Mm-hmm. So understand what I'm saying, because I think that this is like an incredibly controversial issue and topic. And I don't want anyone to think that I'm trying to minimize the problem of racism in the country. Racism is a real problem. But racism, or the topic of racism, has been weaponized by the elite class. So when we have discussions about cancel culture, I'm not thinking about people in, you know, privileged positions getting criticized, but they still get to keep their jobs. They're still fine. I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about what, you know, PR wise, okay? If you are a worker and you want to align yourself with the left, but you see the left digging up old tweets and judging people based on who they used to be, it's not a very welcoming environment, right? You're not going to bring people onto your side if you're harping on things. And let's keep it real. Everyone changes. Everyone evolves. I'm certainly not the same person I was in 2009 when I started my Twitter page, right? And so I think it is important to have discussions so we can support people's evolution and you know, work out some of the biases that people certainly have. But I also think that it's incredibly destructive to create this unwelcoming culture and environment on the left, which will do nothing to bring workers into this movement in order to accomplish what we need to accomplish, which again is all about creating a society that provides basic human rights.
We're going to go on to Portland in a second, but I guess I just wanted to ask quickly, where do you think this comes from? Because for me, this is an outgrowth of the technology. I think Twitter, the way it functions as an archive, very differently to Facebook, for instance. I'm not a particular fan of Facebook, but Twitter is this searchable archive. You can, you know, I can look at Anna Kasparian. What has she said about this particular thing over this particular period? I mean, it's crazy. You know, it really approximates almost a sort of surveillance database available to everyone all of the time. Freddie de Boer wrote a great piece a few years now, I think a few years ago, called Planet of Cops, which I thought was a brilliant piece. And he wrote this sort of mid-cancellation. He sort of left Twitter, left social media. I'm not familiar with much of his work. I don't know if Freddie de Boer was legitimately cancelled or not. But this really stood out as a really compelling, provocative sort of intervention around this stuff. So for you, is this an outgrowth of kind of the left's culture? Because, you know, there's been that historic, you know, the cliche about the left looking for purity and so on. Do you think it's more the technology?
I think technology plays a role, but I think the bigger issue is how successfully these issues surrounding culture do get weaponized by the elite class. Because remember, we're talking about people who have the funding, the infrastructure necessary to create narratives out of thin air. And I see it all the time, right? So they can buy the bots. And, you know, a lot of people can't identify what is and is not a bot on Twitter. They have people in positions of power, people who work in mainstream media that will perpetuate a smear campaign. And so there becomes, as a Twitter user, you feel like increasing pressure to condemn someone or to, you know, message to everybody, hey, I'm a good person because I am condemning this individual.
There's
no hope for this person. And what I'm really trying to communicate here is there is a difference between, you know, the so-called alt-right. There is no save. Like the Trump fans who operate under right-wing media, there's no hope, right? Like you're not going to convince them otherwise. But there are average Americans who might have grown up in an environment that led to that type of ignorance when it comes to race or gender or sexual orientation. And so the only argument that I'm trying to make here is that we should have a dialogue with those people rather than give in to that urge to condemn them and support more division in society. More importantly, more division among workers, right? We need to focus on our common ground and fight for a better society. And once you do that, I think that a lot of the societal issues that we're experiencing right now will be alleviated. Doesn't mean that we're not going to have a problem with racism after that. Of course we are, and that should be addressed. But my point is, you know, there is a difference between these giant public figures who have like crafted this whole identity around racism and then the average person who's just a Twitter user and maybe, you know, they have no following and maybe they tweeted something stupid 5 years ago. Right. Let's not condemn those people. Let's try to have a dialogue with them and fight for, you know, common good.
I mean, I could follow that up with a kind of, you know, responding about how material issues are equally paramount importance to minority groups and so on. But I think I'll pick up on the sort of digital cultural element, and I will finish on this before we move to Portland, which is, I don't know if you're familiar with this, a 41-year-old grime artist, by which I mean he's past his best, Wiley, said some quite controversial things over here a few days ago, a deluge of anti-Semitic tweets. And it felt like people basically had to, people are saying, when will the grime community apologize? When will the black community condemn Wiley? And I was like, and I saw certain leftist figures, for instance, my colleague Ash said, I condemn this, but she kind of had to, because she's had a professional relationship with Wiley in the past. That made sense. But then you've got people who've never met this person being asked to condemn his actions. And you think, in what other context is this healthy, normal behavior? Nobody would ask you to condemn somebody you've never met. You know, nobody would ask you to almost issue a press release for somebody who, you know, but it's kind of, you know, we're all these mini corporations and we're all our own sort of marketing and public relations divisions. And if we don't do the, you know, the right public relations sort of releases, then we're by extension canceled. And it's really, when did this become normal behavior? But anyway, I'll leave that for our audience to perhaps feedback in the comments. Please get those in the comments. We'll be responding to them shortly. Story two, Gary, Portland uprising. Maybe we can see some B-roll while we talk about this. Anna, you can probably explain this a bit better than I can. Portland's been seeing protests now for 61 consecutive days. What's going on there? Because we're seeing some pretty outrageous scenes on a daily, weekly, and now monthly basis there.
Well, the protests in Portland, much like other parts of the United States, began after George Floyd was brutally and violently murdered in broad daylight by cops. And so the protests began, and for the large part, the protests had been peaceful. Unfortunately, there were a few instances of property damage or violence, but overall, everyone except for people who have an interest in defaming this movement agree that the vast majority of these protests have been peaceful. Now, Donald Trump has not been doing well in polling. Various polls for over a month now indicate that Joe Biden is beating Donald Trump in the double digits nationally. And even in swing states, Biden is beating Donald Trump by a fairly large margin. And so Trump found himself in this moment of desperation and really wanted to, present himself as the so-called law and order president, even though what he's doing right now really does violate the constitutional rights of Americans. So what he did is send federal agents to Portland. And the very first weekend this happened, there were videos emerging on social media. And here's something that social media is actually very good for. Videos were emerging on social media showing peaceful protesters who weren't causing any problems, they weren't provoking anyone, getting dragged into unmarked cars by individuals wearing military fatigues. So the federal agents weren't properly labeled. Like, no one knew who they were. They just had a tag that said police. And there's been an ongoing problem with right-wingers showing up to these protests to provoke the protesters. And oftentimes they're wearing military type clothing. And so it was terrifying because so many of these people who were detained weren't ever charged with anything. There was no probable cause, but they were getting snatched up, essentially kidnapped by these federal agents in Portland, taken away and detained for however long. And then they were later released again with absolutely no charges. So that, for understandable reasons, escalated tensions. And so the protests became larger. There would be instances of violence that would be provoked by these federal agents and also by local police. Unfortunately, this has now spread to places like Seattle. And what Trump is attempting to do is use some of the footage from this unrest in his campaign ads to fearmonger about how Joe Biden's America would look like this. The only problem is this is Trump's America. And this is what's happening under Donald Trump. So luckily, we haven't really seen much movement when it comes to his poll numbers. It doesn't appear that his little strategy here is working. But in the meantime, I think what's abundantly clear is that our democracy is incredibly fragile, because we do not have an aggressive enough opposition to what's happening. And so this started in Portland. It's now spreading to other cities. And so, you know, House Democrats are holding a hearing today with William Barr, the attorney general. And how many hearings have we had under the Trump administration? And what did that change? Absolutely nothing. So again, our constitutional rights are being dismantled by this administration. And it is terrifying. It is scary to see just how fragile our democracy really is.
You're saying federal agents. I mean, I keep on saying the word paramilitary is deployed. I mean, what does that mean? Because you don't have a gendarme like France does, for instance. You don't have a federally binding sort of police authority. So who are these guys?
Well, these are agents who work for Customs and Border Patrol, just various agencies within the Department of Homeland Security. And these are agencies that are tasked with normally protecting the border or, surveilling immigration. These are people who are trained to deal with enemy combatants. I mean, they are like paramilitary. And, you know, the thing that frustrates me about American culture, both on the right and the left, and when I say left, I don't mean leftists. I mean Democrats, mainstream Democrats. The problem is that And the media. The problem is that they kind of turned a blind eye to our disgusting and brutal foreign policy for decades, right? It's not a big deal. not a big deal. We're going to, you know, do our drone strikes, our signature strikes. We're going to kill X number of civilians and refer to them as collateral damage. Mm-hmm. But then when that type of behavior abroad turns around, it's like a boomerang effect and yep. negatively impacts us. I mean, of course it's going to happen. Of course it's going to happen. I mean, it all started off with our Pentagon experiencing a massive surplus of military weaponry, because the whole reason why we engage in these endless wars is to make more weapons, got to make sure to fatten the pockets of private defense contractors. And then what do they do with that surplus? They hand it over to local police departments across the country. And then those local police departments brutalize us, American civilians. And so this has been an ongoing issue. I mean, it's devolved into what we're experiencing today, and it'll devolve further unless we get real leadership in this country. But the Democratic establishment fights against real leadership every single day. It's their number one cause.
Yeah, I think it looks almost, there's a quantum difference between what you see in the US and the UK. So for instance, you know, the UK administered, you know, colonial positions for centuries, and there's a really interesting genealogy of the exact same torture techniques that are used in the Boer War, from the beginning of the 20th century. The exact same torture techniques are used in Aden against the Cypriot communists, you know, in all manner of theatres in Malaya, in Kenya by the British, and finally they're used in Ireland. You know, they're used actually all the way, the same tactics, the same techniques, infiltration techniques, etc., all the way through to the early 90s that we know of, right? It could be going on today. Of course, documents, they tend to, well, they remain private in this country for 30 years. And that's just some of them we never see, or most of them we never see. But it seems to me that actually with the US, it's a step worse, because while those tactics, those modes of policing, when they came back home, actually they were primarily focused on Ireland, not just Ireland. You get also black populations, brown populations in Britain, but particularly in Ireland. Whereas, like you say, in your case and in the United States, it seems to have basically just been transplanted onto the homeland. And even in Donald Trump's rhetoric, you know, he said many American cities, I can't remember when he said this or the specifics of it, but he said many American cities are now more dangerous than cities in Afghanistan, which is, I mean, it's patently ridiculous. But that seemed to me almost a tacit admission that, yes, the war of the last 25, 30 years, it's come home. And he sees mm-hmm. impartial observation, which you might agree or disagree with. That's his a rabbit in a hat electoral strategy. Do you think it could win?
Right at this moment, it doesn't appear to be the case, but I'm incredibly uncomfortable feeling any bit of confidence that Joe Biden is going to beat Donald Trump. I've learned my lesson from 2016. Yes, I know we're dealing with a different candidate, but Joe Biden has his own vulnerabilities, really. He's kind of been MIA. He hasn't been out in public much. And of course, he'll say that it's because of coronavirus, which I get. But there are ways to make yourself heard. The thing is, the Biden campaign doesn't feel that it's even necessary to do that, because Donald Trump is so self-destructive that they're just kind of standing back and allowing him to commit foible after foible, whether it's coronavirus or dealing with the unrest in this country. But the thing that really does depress me is that right now I feel like this country is bleeding out. And I want the bleeding to stop. There's no question. And Biden, forgive me for the analogy, is like a used Band-Aid to kind of cover up a gushing wound. So for the foreseeable future, unfortunately, I don't see necessary change happening. Just based on how the DNC voted yesterday on their platform makes it clear mm-hmm. that they have absolutely no interest in committing themselves to changing policy in a way that would actually benefit the vast majority of Americans. The only thing we can hope for at this point, and that doesn't mean that, you know, the American left should stop fighting, but what it looks like for now is that the best that we can get is maybe a little bit of calm, a little bit. But the underlying issues, the fundamental issues that do go back to our hyper-capitalistic system will still be there. The poverty will still be there. The desperation will still be there. The elderly people going into bankruptcy because they can't afford their medical bills will still be there. And it is unbelievably depressing to think about, but we got to keep fighting.
What do you think a Biden presidency might look like? I mean, it might be the case that Biden wins the Electoral College quite handsomely. I think he'll win the popular vote regardless. I think that's relatively uncontentious. I guess where we're not quite sure is voter sort of suppression. And I suppose that dovetails in a really interesting way now with the deployment of these paramilitaries, right? I mean, if they're going to stay in areas where you have large numbers of minority voters, working class voters, et cetera, it could make a significant difference. And I suppose sticking with this idea of America having longstanding problems, I mean, there's a decent argument to make that George W. Bush stole the 2000 presidential election and actually judges basically followed the lead of the media and Republican Party operatives. I suppose that then begs the question, how big a shift needs to happen in the US? And is it possible that the left actually has opportunities in the context of a Biden presidency? Because he's not Obama, you know, Obama's not, you know, okay. So the left, you know, there's an argument to say the left can't, you know, had Obama been around, for instance, Black Lives Matter wouldn't have had the same impact it did this time around. It was born during the Obama presidency, but he had the ability through his persona, his charisma, to co-opt a lot of that energy. That's not happened now. I don't think many people think Joe Biden could do it. So you don't see there's any truth in that, and that kind of, how can I put this, in that contrarian sort of rationale that Joe Biden might actually be an opportunity for the left?
I think that strategically speaking for the left, voting for Joe Biden, if you're in a swing state, that's when your vote really does matter, makes sense. Because if there is any opportunity for change, it would have to be with the Democratic candidate. My only issue is what we're experiencing right now is a Biden campaign that has been pulled in two different directions. And unfortunately, the wrong direction happens to be the most powerful. So there is an organization in America referred to as the Lincoln Project. It's a fairly new organization, and it consists of George Bush era Republicans. These are war hawks. These are individuals who Democrats allegedly couldn't stand during the Bush administration, but they also happen to be never Trump Republicans. They find Trump absolutely hideous. And so they have been funding and putting out these aggressive, and I'll admit, incredibly effective ads against Trump and in support of Biden. So they have provided the Biden campaign material support to win this election. And we're dealing with a, you know, fragmented left right now that's you know, divided based on cultural stuff that really has no power. And so, gee, I wonder who the Biden campaign is going to listen to. There's a reason why the DNC voted the way it did. They are going to vote in favor of the individuals who fund them, the corporations who fund them, the Republicans who help them. And I just think that it's delusional to think that the left in America right now is powerful enough to compete with that. We're just not. No. But that doesn't mean that we stop fighting. I think that the way you fight is, you know, there's been some success when it comes to electoral politics. There's no question about it. So we have a few more progressives elected into Congress. That's definitely going to help. But really, at the heart of an effective movement, you can't rely on any single president. You can't even rely on a Bernie Sanders presidency. And he made that clear. He really wanted to empower the working class. That's what it was about. He wanted to empower workers. And if we're going to get anything done, we need to organize workers. We need general strikes. We need to understand the power that labor has in this country, right? Because if workers decide to strike, these massive corporations have nothing, right? All the power is based in the worker. And so, again, it just goes back to being strategic, having the right messaging, providing a welcoming and non-judgmental culture to bring people in, And finding like-minded individuals who understand that first and foremost, we need to make sure that every single person in this country is living a decent life and is provided with the bare minimum. I mean, just the essentials to survive. Mm. I don't think that's difficult, you know? And so I don't really believe in putting all my eggs in the Joe Biden basket for change.
Oh, no, I don't think Joe Biden, this talk about, oh, Joe Biden will oversee a Green New Deal. Actually, the left has won this. I'm not buying that, but I wonder, you know, that there's one sort of point of view which says Joe Biden is analogous effectively to a 1980s Soviet Union member of the Politburo. You know, he's like Andropov or somebody. Mm-hmm. And he, in a way, personifies the collapse of a ruling class, of a certain political elite. Now, when I say collapse, it doesn't mean that they've got no money. It doesn't mean that they aren't pumping out their propaganda. But they clearly don't have the energy, the vigor, the ideas, the momentum politically that they had in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s to permit political, cultural, and economic renewal. And you see this repeatedly in the American Republic with FDR, with Lyndon Johnson to an extent, with obviously with Kennedy, with Reagan, with Obama. And I suppose the argument is that this, I think he's 77. I sound so ageist, I keep on talking about people's age. This 77-year-old guy, and then you've got Nancy Pelosi, she's 80. It, you know, that in itself shows a quite desiccated political class. And if those are the people in charge, I think that may permit a space for the left beyond it to do things. I'm not saying Biden makes anything mm-hmm. possible himself, but there's perhaps an optimism there in just how desiccated these people in their politics look. Perhaps.
I think that's a fair point, but you also have to kind of take a step back and look at the incentive structure in our political system. And as long as special interests are considered, you know, humans with the same constitutional rights as I have, right, then it's always the message, the desires of the general public will always be drowned out by the funding provided by those special interests. That's a very big issue. I mean, when you look at the amount of funding Obama received from like Citibank right before he went into office, that is significant. That has a huge impact on how he governed. That had a huge impact on how he governed. So those elements of our broken system still exist. I think that, you know, you can find incredibly principled individuals who want to run for Congress or want to do the right thing. But those people are rare, very rare. When you have all these negative influences and this broken system and this incentive structure, you just have this uphill battle, you know, to deal with. So, you know, unfortunately, our Supreme Court ruled in the wrong way, you know, in Buckley v. Valeo and also with Citizens United. And as a result, we're suffering the consequences of special interests, you know, taking priority over the best interests of the American people.
Here's one thing that you guys have, though, and it's a bit of a segue to the final part of the conversation, which is about Nancy Pelosi potentially, well, she's effectively being primaried. You have that primary system, which means that politicians don't necessarily have jobs for life. And I think that, and that is a way of keeping politicians honest in a way that we don't have over here in the UK. So, you know, somebody could be elected the local MP. If they win a general election, there's only one candidate from one party in a particular constituency. They don't need to talk to the membership. They don't even need to sort of canvass very much if their majority is quite a big one, because it happens to be a historically Labour or Conservative area. You have the primary system, which I think it does create a certain, it counters some of those incentives in a way that I think really can't be overstated. So that's my view, because we've had a big battle in this country over mandatory selection, open selection for Labour MPs. We lost. I think to me, it's a very self-evidently necessary thing in politics. This story is from The Intercept. Interesting story. Shahid Buttar is challenging Nancy Pelosi in the November general election. Here's the quote. Buttar represents a unique, if unlikely, challenge to Pelosi, the most powerful elected Democrat in the country, and 33-year incumbent for San Francisco's congressional seat. On Tuesday, Pelosi took 72.5% of the vote in California. This is a while back. California's 12th congressional district, under the state's unique primary system, where the top two vote getters in the primary make it to the general election, even if they belong to the same party, which means that Buttar, with 12.7%, also goes forward. quote, Shahid going one-to-one against Nancy will shine a spotlight on precisely how little she has done for the district in the midst of a housing crisis, an opioid crisis, and out-of-control cost of living. The election will also reveal her role in exacerbating these issues that remain at the forefront of voters' minds both today and in November. Now, you're right to say about big money. This is an interesting thing, though, which Buttar tweeted, I think it was either yesterday or today. Pelosi's raised, I think, $12, $13 million, but he's raised $1.4 million. Now, I'm not saying he's going to win, but for a Democrat going up against, you know, the most senior Democrat right now in American politics, that seems like quite the achievement. I guess I want your take on this around a few sort of key questions, which I think most British viewers be completely ignorant around. Does he have any chance of winning? What does success look like? And how does this feed into the stuff that you've been talking about more generally about organizing workers, about creating a broader left? Yes, within electoral politics, but also beyond it.
Yeah, so based on how, you know, things are looking, and I have noticed that there have been some negative articles written about him, you know, very conveniently as of late. It looks unlikely that Shahid Buttar is going to beat Nancy Pelosi, but I do agree that it does shine a spotlight on the failures of Democratic leadership, particularly the failures of Nancy Pelosi. I mean, we're talking about a woman who thought it was a good idea to show off her fancy, luxurious ice cream right in front of her $24,000 refrigerator. Well, it's two $12,000 refrigerators that she has in that kitchen of hers. But nonetheless, I mean, that she gets applauded for the optics all the time. Pretty bad optics in the middle of a pandemic to do what she did. But, you know, I do agree that it doesn't necessarily, there is some success in primarying an incumbent politician and highlighting where they've fallen short. And with Nancy Pelosi and Democratic leadership overall, they have fallen short in pretty much every policy you can imagine. Mm-hmm. They have focused primarily on weaponizing identity politics and focusing on the optics of resistance. But when it comes to, you know, legitimate actions that improve the lives of Americans, they've done nothing. And they've done very little when it comes to challenging Donald Trump. Yes, the House impeached him. But impeaching him the way that they did didn't go far enough. They didn't focus on his financial crimes.
Yeah.
And one must wonder, why is it that out of all of the issues that they could focus on, including the easy to understand and digest issues like tax fraud, for instance, or violations of the emoluments clause, why didn't they focus on that? Why are they so hyper-focused on, oh, the Ukraine angle, Russia, all of that, right? And I really think that they have an interest in protecting one another when it comes to financial issues.
So true. I mean, he's basically spent like a year. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. He's spent a huge amount of time at sort of Mar-a-Lago, and he's basically been on holiday a lot of the time in a way that no previous American president has. And it feels like people are pulling their punches on that, because maybe quite a lot of them do something quite similar. You know, I don't know. We saw something similar happen here in the UK in 2009 with the MP's expenses scandal. All of a sudden, there was this deluge of MPs spending money on crazy things, like, you know, a duck house in the middle of their pond, an island in the middle of their pond, and a duck house, the most famous example. But none of them really talked about it because they were all effectively guilty. Do you think there's something similar going on with the way that the impeachment proceedings played out?
I absolutely do. I'll give you one example. And this is actually an example I was reading about yesterday when I was trying to understand why a former senator, Chris Dodd, was going after Senator Kamala Harris. Now, Politico had reported on that in a way that was suspect, to say the least. I wanted to look into it further. And I realized that Senator Dodd was actually under an ethics investigation in, I believe, 2009, because he had received two mortgages from Countrywide, where the CEO had put him on a VIP list, and the interest rate on those mortgages were considerably lower than the interest rates that the general public was receiving. So, of course, the Senate did their ethics investigation and they cleared him of any wrongdoing because they protect one another. Yeah. But these types of financial dealings, the bribery, the favoritism, the favors, all of that takes place. And it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican, if you're in a position of power and you are tempted to use that position of power for all sorts of financial favors, yeah, you're going to do it. And you're going to shut your mouth if one of your fellow senators or congresspeople, congressman or woman, engages in the same behavior. It's the kind of stuff that we're seeing by members of Congress right now is really shameful, especially when you consider the insane amount of poverty in this country. I mean, before the pandemic, and of course the pandemic has made things worse, the Federal Reserve released a study showing that nearly 50% of Americans, that's half of Americans, can't afford a $400 emergency. Mm. It's in the richest country, one of the richest countries in the world. Again, shameful. We have, and this is the reason why Congress year after year has such a low approval rating. I think the majority of Americans understand that they're doing very little for us, and it needs to change.
Yeah, I guess the question is, how do you make sure that doesn't deviate into anti-politics and become something propositional and empowering? I guess we'll finish with Michael Brooks. Passed away a little over a week ago. Obviously, all our the condolences and thoughts are with Michael's friends, family, former co-workers. You worked with him at Jacobin. You've known him for quite a while. How would you describe him and his sort of political legacy? How do you think he should be remembered?
Well, I think that Michael and his show, his messaging meant a lot to a lot of different people. I can only speak for myself. And, you know, for me, Michael posed a giant challenge to my political identity. And he is the number one influence in pushing me further to the left, really. And he did so through openness, through making me feel accepted and, you know, not judging me in any way. And making me realize that, hey, you know, there are certain critiques that I haven't been exposed to and I should look into. And it was an uncomfortable process for me internally. But what made it a little easier was that the person portraying the news, the messages, the ideology that I needed to learn about was coming from someone like Michael. He just had this incredible ability to show kindness and understanding while also informing you about things that we just don't ever hear in mainstream media. You know, America is very insular. The news seems to pretend as if no other country exists unless we're planning on invading it. And Michael had this incredible ability of, you know, teaching Americans, and not just Americans, people around the world, about incredible leaders, about, you know, U.S.-led coups that overthrew democratically elected leaders in Latin America. You know, he taught me about Pepe Mujica, for instance. And I miss him every single day because aside from the political component of it, he was a friend who I could vent to, who, you know, I could, you know, share something with. I could tell him about people coming after me for whatever reason. And he would always approach it with snark and humor, and he would make me feel that everything's going to be all right. It's okay. He was a person who made every day a little better. And, you know, not having him around anymore is absolutely devastating. And I'm still grappling with it, to be honest.
Yeah, there was, I think it was on a podcast I was listening to, True and On podcast, a few days ago. And there was a beautiful sort of encomium to Michael, for want of a better word, but it was beautiful when it was his own words, and he was talking about political figures that perhaps most of us, I certainly hadn't heard of until very recently, Cabral and, you know, Cape Verde, and, you know, pursue no easy victories, take no easy victories, and he talked about this in a very poetic, intelligible way. That's the thing, and that's really impressive, right? You're talking about a revolutionary ideologue in Cape Verde, you know, take no easy victories. And yet it was incredibly intelligible, and it cut through in a way that I thought, wow, very, very powerful. And I spoke briefly to Bhaskar at Jacobin about this. And I said, you know, people that are very, very rare, you know, and political movements depend on them. You know, they're backbone. And so from our side, he'll be very, very sorely missed. But hopefully you can, I'm sure you will, on the American left, take his legacy forward.
I hope so. I mean, Michael is one of a kind. And, you know, we're going to do our best to carry out his message and his teachings. And, you know, his crew over at the Michael Brooks Show, just incredible people, you know, Matt Leck, Ben Burgess, David Griscom, they're still planning on continuing the show. So please tune in if you guys, you know, haven't already. And, you know, we need solidarity, not just here in the United States, but around the world. So thank you for inviting me on the show and having this conversation with me.
Well, our pleasure. You've been hugely illuminating on some incredibly important issues. I mean, story after story right now with the US, it just feels like the Republic's in freefall. Okay, that might be mediatized, it might sound hyperbolic, but there's certainly nothing like it in my lifetime. So we'll have you on, I'm sure, in the next couple of months. Anna, enjoy the rest of your day. See you soon.
Thank you. Thank you
Bye.
So much.
Bye. Anna is just fantastic. I love Anna's work. I've been following her for many, many years. So happy we have her on Navarra Media. If you enjoyed tonight's show, smash the subscribe button. YouTube are playing games with us at the moment. We're having a kind of, I think, shadow banning thing. I don't want to sort of go into conspiracy theories, but it feels sometimes like we're not getting through to our audience. So smash the like button, hit the subscribe button, and also there's that bell notification. So you'll always be among the first to know when our latest content is up and running. Furthermore, if you liked the show yesterday, Tisky Sour, there's this, there are articles, there's the Cortado. We do a great deal of work, just like Anna was talking about with the American Left across the Atlantic. We're trying to pursue a new media for different politics. If you want to help us do that, go to navarromedia.com/support. My name's Aaron Bastani. This has been The Bastani Factor. I'll see you the same time, same place next week.
This broadcast is brought to you by Navarra Media. Go to navarromedia.com/support.